Always a pleasure to have you with us. And if you miss the programs or want to pass along any of these programs to any of your family or friends, they're always available posted on carolcobyradio.com. Carol Coby, K-O-B-Y, radio.com. If you're out of the listening area, you can also listen to WTDY day or night by opening your computer and going to WTDY.com. And our programs are screened live on the internet. And now we have a new way of connecting with WTDY, and there's a free app for your cell phone. So you can get the WTDY app and have it there sitting as an icon every time you click your cell phone on. But right now we're live in the studio, and this segment of our program is brought to you by Oak Park Place, where you can live life and live well. And today is really a Wisconsin sports day. I know there's a big basketball game this afternoon between Wisconsin and Marquette, always a strong rivalry, and that will be exciting. And that will get over just in time for people to get ready and prepare to watch or cheer on the Badgers playing Michigan State. The outcome of that game will be the winner will go to the Rose Bowl. And I was just commenting before we went on the air that this reminds me of 1994, or actually the fall of 93, when we were in contention for the Rose Bowl and we had to play Michigan State and win that game. And that game was in Japan. And I remember that my husband and I sat up, we set the alarm because the game was at some ungodly time, like one or two o'clock in the morning. Right.
So many people stayed in the bars and watched.
Oh, it was so exciting. I had actually, because I was a student at the university in the 60s when we went to the Rose Bowl. So I had been to the Rose Bowl in 63. And now here we were finally 31 years later having the opportunity to potentially go to the Rose Bowl. I was so excited. And so it was that final game with Michigan State taking place in Japan that made the decision. So we watched the game, and at 4 o'clock in the morning or whatever, when we handily won. And I don't know, do you remember, Nino, watching that game where they had the flags? And if you had a red flag, that was like cheering.
Sure.
And they'd wave the flags, you know, the Japanese people. And the other side had a green flag or whatever. It was so fun to watch, and we handily beat them. And of course, we went to the Rose Bowl and we won. And that was so exciting. And I recall at 4 or 4:30 in the morning, whenever the game was over, I said, "We're going to the Rose Bowl." And I jumped up and went to the phone and I called my mother. And I woke her up in the middle of the night. But she was delighted and she knew how excited I was. And she said, "Hello," you know. And I said, "We're going to the Rose Bowl."
And if I can add, when I was in college,
yeah,
we were not on a winning streak. In fact, I don't think we had won a single game in two or three seasons. And when we finally tied a game in the third season at the end of the year, you think we won the Super Bowl. We were so thrilled. And I think it was Milt Bruhn, who actually had a very successful career, but
yes,
then he hit
he
a down
did.
Period. But that was also during the Vietnam War, so people were focused on other things.
Yes.
But during those 4 years, we'd go to the Badger games. We'd lose. Everybody would still have fun. But boy, when we tied that one, I can't even think of the team. The fact that we tied
was a success.
So.
Well, I remember there was a period where when we got first downs, it was a big deal.
Sure it was.
So it's all relative. It's all where your perspective is. But it's fun. And Wisconsin sports, we always have here in Wisconsin, the Badgers are enthusiastic about our teams and the Packers and even the Brewers this year. So it's been a good year sports-wise. And you hear the voice in the background. We're having this conversation, and I should introduce my guest to you. If you don't know already, it is Nino Amato, a very well-known name. And I remember your parents so well and
on
going
Park Street,
to,
sure.
Park Street, going into the restaurant, and they would always be sitting in that front booth, and they'd greet you like your old family friends, and always have a glass of wine on us.
Sure. They'd bring special homemade appetizers to the table or things like that.
Yeah.
They were down there for close to 50 years. It was quite the establishment. And then they sold it to a Mexican family, and that's the La Hacienda, which is very good food.
So, yes, it is. Very popular. But talk about old-time Madison treasures and establishments.
Sure. Yeah, you had...
it's not just buildings, it's people.
Well, it's Josie's, was there. And then you had Namio's. And then some of the remaining ones are Gino's on State Street.
Yes.
and was it Bellinis, which is the other Gargano family. So those are really the last two remaining. And Pepino closed Pepino's, I think, about a year and a half ago.
It wasn't long.
But those were all the established Italian families in town. In fact, Park and Regent Street used to be called Spaghetti Corners because at each corner was an Italian restaurant.
Yeah,
you had Josie's, then you had Joe Aiello's place, Tiny Spaghetti House, and Pino's, which was owned by the Cappadona family. And then down the road was Amato's, and then further down Park Street was Namio. So it was quite an era.
Well, I miss those good old days.
Sure.
It was a really special time.
Yeah, you could pull up in the parking lot and smell the garlic.
Yeah. And I know that you still have some of those recipes, and you take your turn in the kitchen
on
the home front. So it's always fun to have some of your homemade cooking brings back Amato's and all of those other fine restaurants. But now you're on to other things. And Nino is here today as president and executive director of the Coalition of Wisconsin Aging Groups. And the Coalition of Wisconsin Aging Groups was really founded in 1977.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And you are, what, a nonpartisan organization?
Nonpartisan, nonprofit organization.
Statewide membership organization. And you do advocacy, education,
legislation. Legal advocacy. We consumer protection. We help people with Medicare Part D transitions, people who are trying to transition to Social Security. We also help people who are being financially abused by some of the healthcare insurance companies where they paid healthcare premiums for years and now they don't want to reimburse them for the medical expenses. So we provide a whole sort of services and we function on federal state grants. We have quite a few progressive corporations who support our efforts because they're worried about their employees and their children and grandchildren. So it's an organization that's been around since 1977. What was really interesting, it started with 5,500 seniors and their children who paid a visit to the state capitol one day. And I remember that well because I was a graduate student and on the Madison City Council. And the square was lined with yellow buses because people came from all over the state.
Mm-hmm.
And we have this great picture of Governor Pat Lucey, the Republican leadership who controlled the legislature at the time, meeting everybody in the rotunda. And we were able to advance five pieces of legislation that most everybody has taken for granted. The development support of senior centers, nutrition programs, property tax relief, public transportation for the elderly, and public transportation for the elderly. And so a year later, the coalition was formed, and we have Republicans and Democrats and Libertarians on our board. Each board member is elected in each one of our 10 districts, so it's really grassroots. And then those individuals elect the leadership. And then I report to 30 individuals on my board. So it's a great cross-section of people. And because we have, we're nonpartisan and we look at the issues and we have people on both sides of the aisle on our board, we focus on the facts and we try to protect our seniors. And many of the issues today that affect our seniors also affect our children and grandchildren.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. And you're known also for your Elder Law Center. And
yes.
You have many, many calls that come in all kinds of areas, legal issues, where you advance the issues of seniors.
And yesterday we had a Supreme Court hearing where we were a friend of the court. It's called an amicus brief. And our attorney, Maren Bierman, wrote the amicus brief. And it was all about how you're going to find Alzheimer's under two statutes, Statute 55, Statute 51. And the county of Fond du Lac is trying to say that if someone who has Alzheimer's and are being physically disruptive in a nursing home, that now what they want to do is file under Chapter 51 to declare them as having a mental illness so they can institutionalize them. This is incredible. It is just absolutely beyond anyone's belief that if that should take effect, what impact that will have on the rights of people who have dementia or Alzheimer's. So we're stating to the Supreme Court that it's wrong, that using Chapter 55 allows all the flexibility. But what you have are some nursing homes that don't want to deal with some of these issues.
Mm-hmm.
And in this one case, the woman's name was Helen, 83 years old, and she advanced stages of Alzheimer's, and she couldn't communicate well. And she was only 100 pounds, and she was getting physical with some of the caretakers. Well, they then put her in an institution. What they should have done was examine to find out if there was anything physically wrong. And here she had a urinary tract infection. And that's what she was doing, was communicating because she was in pain.
Yes.
So now we're going to put these people and institutionalize them in a mental institution where the fellow next door to her was 300 pounds who had a long history of physical violence. I mean, this would be wrong. If someone tried to do that to my mother or a friend or a loved one, that's appalling. So it's a very serious case, and they heard arguments yesterday. And we hope to hear a decision within the next, hopefully, 2 to 3 months.
So if it does not pass that they would institutionalize them, how would they be treated? In this case, they assess the person, and I thought they did that with all people with dementia, that they assess them to eliminate potential causes for the dementia.
Right, and what we're arguing is that we have flexibility under Chapter 51 and Chapter 55. We obviously favor Chapter 55 because there's greater due process in that. And that if the Supreme Court feels that there's a need, then the need should be legislated, but it shouldn't be legislated from the bench. Supreme Court Justice Prosser has excused himself, apparently, for this session of votes. I don't know why. So if it should split from a party line, it'll be 3-3, which means we'll win the appellate court. But what's interesting in hearing the arguments and talking to Marin and our staff attorneys who attended, because I wasn't able to attend the full two sessions. This isn't party line. There was a lot of good questions asked by conservative judges and moderate liberal judges. I think there's a real sincere concern about what impact does this have. So it's going to be a very important decision that will have huge waves if it goes in favor of Fond du Lac County. If it supports the position that the other advocates want, then it sustains it, but it raises a concern that we have overall that why would even people want to think in these terms? We've been a leader in so many things in protecting people with dementia and Alzheimer's. And yes, there are cases where it can be pretty violent.
Yes.
But you have to have the process. And you also have to deal with other issues because it may not be a family member who's the guardian. It may be a corporate guardian. So it's very complex. I simplified it for purposes of people beginning to raspy ideas.
Well, it just so shows the level of complexity in some of these issues. And Alzheimer's and dementia, it's almost exploding. It's becoming an epidemic because of our aging population. And the risk factors, number one being age, but then there are other risk factors. And there are cases even at an early onset.
Oh, sure. I have a friend who basically got the early onset of Alzheimer's at age 56. And boy, if that doesn't stop you in your track and stop to think. And he ate right, he exercised, he did all the right things, and there it is. And we as baby boomers, and anyone who's listening, those of us born between 1946 and 1964, we have a greater chance of having advanced stages of dementia as well as Alzheimer's. So, you know, I look at this whole issue that here, you know, let me step back. Tom Brokaw's book, The Greatest Generation Ever.
Mm-hmm.
When you stop to look at our parents' generation, they went through a depression. They fought a war. We could have been dominated by the Nazis and the Japanese from the standpoint of their fascist tactics for the world for 50 years. They did everything right, and they made every sacrifice. Now, they're in those fundamental, vulnerable years, and we're going to treat them in the fashion that some people are proposing to cut Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, and now there's an attempt to deal with people who have Alzheimer's or dementia and possibly declare them as mentally ill to institutionalize them. Something is morally wrong with that type of thinking. It's almost like a survival of the fittest. That's not the America that we were founded on. So to do that to the greatest generation or any generation is just beyond my imagination. That a year ago, if someone had asked me we were dealing with such a case, I would have just said, oh, you got to be kidding. Mm-hmm. But the world's changed.
Yes,
and
it
so I know we got off a little bit off a track, but
it's on my list.
Yeah. Well, the coalition is there, and we've worked with Republican governors. In fact, we had honored Governor Tommy Thompson and U.S. Senator Herb Kohl at our last convention. We recognize people who are there to protect children and seniors, and we've seen good leadership from both parties, and we've also seen bad leadership from both parties. And we're there to state the facts and to protect people.
But what you're underscoring in this whole discussion, when you talk about working on both sides and you've seen good and bad from both sides, is really the power of policy. And that's one thing that I have learned in my continuing years of doing this program and working with people like you and others, that one person or one small organization can do good for another individual or another small group. But to change society and provide a standard for society, you really need to impact policy.
Yeah, absolutely. I think here's a classic case. Those who are familiar with senior care and those who aren't, let me give you a quick caption. Under the Bush Jr. administration, President George W. Bush supported a law that prevents our federal government from negotiating the lowest possible drug cost with pharmaceutical industry, which is bizarre. Every other country in the world, free world, can do this. And I'll give you an example what impact this has. Lipitor. Now it's coming off as a brand name.
Yes.
But Lipitor was costing a recipient here, and it's basically for
High cholesterol.
$2.88 a pill. Now, multiply that times 3 by 12. It's over $1,000. You go across the border to Canada, and it's a dollar cheaper. You go to France, and it's even cheaper yet. If you go to New Zealand, it's even cheaper. It's 72 cents a pill.
And they have negotiated with the pharmaceutical
they
companies for these prices.
They have negotiated with the pharmaceutical companies. So under the leadership of Governor Tommy Thompson, and who later became U.S. Department of Health and Human mm-hmm. Services Secretary under Bush, and Senator Herb Kohl, they worked together to get Wisconsin to be the only state be exempt to negotiate the lowest possible cost for our seniors. So they created senior care, which is 92,000 of our seniors are on senior care. And there's not an asset test. You pay $30 a year. It's easy to apply. And it has huge cost savings. And the reason why Senator Kohl, Democrat, Governor Tommy Thompson, Republican, supported that is because they were recognizing that the cost of drugs were going so high, people were either splitting their medication, taking their medication every other day so they could at least eat.
Right.
And this is a way to
protect
people.
Food or medications or rent or medications.
Yeah. And this new administration came in and decided to force people off of senior care and have them all apply to Medicare Part D. Now, Medicare Part D is one of the most complicated, convoluted prescription drug program created by the pharmaceutical industry that makes tens of millions of dollars off it.
On that, we're going to stop for a break, and everybody will be tense and sitting next to the radio to hear the continuation of this story. Our guest today is Nino Amato, who is president and executive director of the Coalition of Wisconsin Aging Groups. And you're listening to All About Living here on Madison 1670 WTDY. We'll be back with more of our conversation with Nino Amato right after these messages. Welcome back to our program, and this segment is brought to you by Gunderson Funeral and Cremation Care, the Life Celebration Center. Our guest today is Nino Amato, president and executive director of the Coalition of Wisconsin Aging Groups, an organization that was formed in 1977 of people, seniors, and their families from throughout the state of Wisconsin. And basically, your theme is advocating for all generations, but you focus on policy, on issues, on those critical needs and resources for the senior population. Is that correct,
Yes,
Nino?
Very correct. Mm-hmm. Well, because when you look at things like consumer protection, we just received a big grant from the United States Justice Department. Wisconsin is one of 10 states to prevent identity fraud, but not just for the elderly. It's kids. I'll give you a very scary statistic. California followed and tracked children who basically were in foster homes. And by the time they turned 18, 50% of those children had their identity stolen. Now, some were from foster parents, some who have moved frequently, unfortunately, and so every time they move and they register their Social Security in school or someplace else, there's a greater chance someone's going to discover it. So here you have these kids who were dealt an unfair deck of cards, and they don't have parents. They're now in foster homes. They go out in the real world, and lo and behold, their identity's been stolen, and it takes years to get their credit back.
Mm-hmm.
Seniors are becoming more and more victimized by the same thing. Seniors, especially the greatest generation ever, okay, and the baby boomers, tend to trust people more often than maybe they should. And there's so many con artists out there that get a hold of people's Social Security numbers, their Medicaid, Medicare numbers, and they steal their identity. And so we have built a coalition. We're actually going to have a press conference week after next. We have people from the State Justice Department, the Federal Justice Department. We have Republicans and Democrats together on this issue. And here's a classic case where we're advocating for all generations. What's good for seniors is good for foster children. It's good for everybody.
Yeah, so, some things don't matter. It doesn't matter if you've turned 65 or if you've turned 26.
That's right.
Yeah, the issues are the same
all
for people who are living in society.
And actually, the intergenerational approach is not new to CWAG. At the 1986 convention in Oshkosh, that's when they actually adopted an intergenerational platform. In the building that my predecessor raised money for, which is the coalition building out in the Research Dairy Park, is called the Intergenerational Center. And so we've broadened our approach. And most importantly, we're looking at those baby boomers who are retiring 10,000 each day since the first of the year for the next 20 years.
I know.
And they're concerned about their retirement plans. They're concerned about their kids. And they're definitely concerned about their grandkids. So it all really comes together quite nicely.
Even many of the senior centers are becoming intergenerational centers. And
absolutely,
mixing the generations and having the generations find, it's not an age thing that binds them, it's a common interest.
Absolutely. And in fact, I used to laugh. My mother passed away a year ago, April, but she was 84. And she would say, you know, I'm tired of being around old people.
I know.
And there really is a movement. I shared with you earlier, I took part in a World Health Organization conference in Dublin on age-friendly cities and communities. And the whole concept is intergenerational housing, clean environment, public transportation for all. And those communities who adopt those Dublin Accords and move in that direction will be very successful of attracting people of all generations to their communities. So it's all relative, and it's great. And this is one of, you know, I'm a classic baby boomer. I could have retired and taught. Someday I will go in the classroom and teach. But this is my encore career where I'm putting together all my skill sets, working with a great team of people, volunteers from all over the state. There's over 100,000 members when you add the organizations and the individual memberships. And I couldn't think of a better job. It's every day we finish, I hear success stories from our staff of how we've helped people. And every morning we have a new challenge. Sometimes these challenges get a little bit strong, but we do our best to manage them.
Well, I think there's just a wealth of experience that can make major contributions to our society today. And the new, I have a friend who does a newsletter and does a lot on communications and having productive lives all your life. But he said that retirement is a word that needs to be retired. And he talks about pro-tirement. And you may not, you know, you may retire from what you've been doing for 40 years or whatever, but you retire to something and and make a contribution in another way, or perhaps even hone in more on the actual skills and strengths that you have.
Well, the new 60s and the new 40s. The baby boomers are going to change the definition of aging. So we're going to go through another paradigm shift. But if I could jump back to senior care, we had talked about senior care cost.
Mm-hmm.
The average cost for people on senior care, looking at the 2009 data, was roughly, I think, $508 a year. On Medicare Part D, which is a private sector pharmaceutical drug, was $1,688. So what the governor and Secretary Smith proposed was forcing people to apply for Medicare Part D, which would have cost millions of dollars to even administer that. We met with him and his administration during the transition period and convinced him that this was a good program, that it's a bipartisan program and he should support it. For whatever reason.
And it's the only program of its kind in the country.
Absolutely. We had a great supporter inside the administration, Kitty Rhodes. She's a former assembly person. Well-skilled, knows healthcare issues exceptionally well. And I sensed, this is my opinion, that she was very much supportive of what we wanted to do to preserve senior care. We then informed the governor's office that we'll have to take this fight to the legislature. And we did.
Because Governor Walker, in his original budget, had removed senior care.
Well, what he wanted to do was force people onto Medicare Part D and force over $100 million of cost onto the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
So we took the case to the Republican leadership and the Democratic leadership. We got our organizations around the state and all 72 counties involved. People made phone calls. We had a petition drive. We had Republicans, Democrats working together. And what was really great, we had grandkids and children saying, what are you doing to our grandparents? Uh-huh. We should preserve senior care. And, you know, the person who I respect is Cheryl Albert, who basically was on joint finance and committed herself to Alberta Darling, I'm sorry.
Alberta Darling,
who committed herself to support senior care. Shortly after that, Scott Fitzgerald committed, and so does Jeff Fitzgerald. And the Democratic leadership did as well from the very beginning. So we worked with Democrats and Republicans. Now, it wasn't pleasant, and let me say this, because it was very partisan, very emotional, and there were times when I'd be threatened by one party or the other that if you hold a press conference with that party, we're going to do this to you and so on and so forth. But we did what was right, and we got people together, and we preserved senior care. Now,
that's one of the few successes of bipartisanship that has occurred since the Walker administration came into power.
I thank both leadership, Republican and Democrats, for pushing this issue and coming together. So we can come together, and that's really important. Now, the real litmus test for this administration will be whether or not they will ask the federal government to extend senior care beyond the December 31st, 2012 deadline. We did send a letter to Mr. Smith and to the governor August 16th. We have not heard back whether they're going to do it, but now we're working with a bipartisan group in the state legislature, Senator Tim Cullen, mm-hmm. and also Dale Schultz.
Senator Dale Schultz.
And we believe we have enough bipartisan support to get the Senate to go on record to support the extension, and then we're going to move to the Assembly and do the same thing. And there's even another proposal we had proposed to the governor, and we hope he steps forward and helps. If not, we'll have to go to the legislature like we did before. And that is the way senior care is calculated. It is paid primarily by the pharmaceutical industry, over 75%. And if you take right now, you pay $30 a year, depending upon your income, you could have no deductible, you could have $250, $500, $875 deductible or $1,000 deductible. Every time the state puts in a dollar, the pharmaceutical companies match that tenfold. So what we're proposing is going to a co-insurance payment, which means that the state pays half of your deductible, you pay half your deductible. What that does, it brings in over close to $7 million of additional pharmaceutical rebates, lowers the cost of senior care by $3.3 million, and nets the state of Wisconsin $1.9 million. Now, someone's going to scratch their head and say, well, how can that be? That's the federal formula. But we know it, and we're asking the administration to request that that exemption is made and that adjustments made. One, we bring in more money, we can reach more people. So we're waiting for the governor and Secretary Smith.
And the state
Smith.
Of Wisconsin benefits financially from
Absolutely.
This.
Absolutely. And let me just say this. Let me talk about the hardball politics. Behind the scenes, the pharmaceutical industry wanted to force everybody on Medicare Part D. The Medicare Part D program. The reason being is they don't like senior care because they're afraid other states are going to follow. And they're more concerned about their short-term profits than they are about helping seniors and all of us at some point in time. And let's not also forget, you know, this whole healthcare issue has huge ramifications on our children. So, you know, it really gets down to should healthcare be a commodity and it should be the survival of the fittest? Or should healthcare be what we're doing in every other country where you take a Warren Buffett, a Steve Jobs, a Bill Gates that says if this country is truly going to be competitive, we have to have some form of a safety net for healthcare. And no one wants to admit it, but we have national healthcare in this country. It's called the emergency
room. Oh, I know.
One of the most expensive forms of healthcare in the world. And guess who pays for that?
Us, the premium holders,
not the providers. And I will say this on behalf of many of the providers, they don't like it either. And in fact, we probably have three of the best progressive hospitals in our region who've all gone on record in support of some type of universal healthcare program. So it really boils down.
I have talked to health professionals from all three organizations across the board. They are all in favor of some kind of healthcare that's provided across the board for people, that's available to people to get them into a system for the prevention, for the screenings, to catch it up early. It's changing the model from the Hail Mary to a prevention model.
The other thing, too, is there's a myth out there. People think we have the best healthcare system in the world. Well, if you base it on the amount that we spend per capita and outcomes, we rank 23 out of 24 mm-hmm. of the industrialized nations. We pay twice as much as Japan does, and our outcomes are nowhere as near as Japan.
I saw a list of outcomes on a number of health issues the other day, and we're way down in all of these major areas, the chronic illnesses and the diseases,
The reason why in other countries they do not charge people a deductible or a copay for prevention and wellness. We built, I think, a very good healthcare system per se. It's dysfunctional now at best, and it's broken. But we built a healthcare system that if you fall off the cliff, you're going to get pretty good care. Well, it's time to put a fence on top of that cliff. And the Affordable Care Act, which is really interesting, if you ask people, do you support, you know, Obamacare? Oh, people go off the walls. But if you ask them simple questions like, do you think it is good and will cost people less that if you get into prevention and wellness, would you support such a program? 80-some percent of the people say yes. When you ask people, do you think health insurance companies should deny people with pre-existing conditions? They say, no, that's not fair. Okay. Again, 80-some percent support. Do you think that children should stay on the family's insurance policy until age 26? High ratings. That's all Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. And so given the...
There's a lot of
misinformation.
Information on it.
It's what I call false evidence appearing real. And if you take the initials, false evidence appearing real, it's
fear.
Called fear.
Mm-hmm.
And death panels, you know, socialism. I mean, I had people saying, get government out of my health care, but protect Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, that is government.
That is government. Affordable Care Act is not.
Yeah.
The Affordable Care Act, and when people say, well, I don't want government making, you know, in between me and my doctor, all the Affordable Care Act does is tell insurance companies what they can no longer not do. I mean, they can't deny people coverage for pre-existing conditions. And they have to cover prevention and wellness and those kinds of issues. So it expands the doctor-patient relationship, but it doesn't get in the way of the doctor-patient relationship. The insurance company still pays for
it. And it was Richard Nixon who basically expanded Medicare.
Yes.
And did the things that were needed. In fact, if you look at a lot of the progressive Republicans, they are on the side of the Affordable Care Act for everything they've done, going all the way far back as Teddy Roosevelt, who raised concerns about the affordability of health care, accessibility, and outcomes, you know, to Eisenhower, to Nixon, to Gerald Ford. I mean, it's
And it
really
was a Republican idea for the mandate of insurance, that have to have coverage for everybody in order for it to pencil out and for the insurance companies to make some money.
Through the Freedom of Information Act, historians have now discovered documents where Richard Nixon was going to propose national health care so we can compete with Europe and other nations. And what's really interesting when people use the word socialism, Japan is a very strong competitor. They have national health care. Germany is a very strong competitor. They have national health care. Their costs are half of our costs. Their outcomes are better. So we've got to get over this paradigm fear tactic that's going on in this country. And if you look at the manufacturing end of this country and the assembly of automobiles, many of the assembly plants are moving to Canada. The reason being is they have national health care, and it's $2,000 less per car. Now people say, oh, you know, Canada, you wait in lines. Mm-hmm. Well, I ask someone out there today, call up and see when you can get your next physical. It's 6 months to a year away. If you call some of the University of Wisconsin departments for specialty things, it is 90, 80, 180 days away. So the key is one size does not fit all. But the United States is in a unique position today that can look at the best of class in each one of these other countries that have basically had national health care for decades and decades and figure out a model and a system that works for everybody.
Half of all bankruptcies is because of medical costs.
There is no other nation in the world that allows people to go into poverty because of medical costs. And it hits young and old.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter, Katrina, graduated from the University of California, Long Beach, in the fine arts program. And a very dear friend of hers couldn't get health care because she couldn't afford it because of her student loans. Now, had the Affordable Care Act gone on, she would have been able to stay under her parents' insurance rates because the way it was, you had to be a full-time student, or she wasn't. So 2 months after graduation, the dancers could realize that Anne was having difficulties and she was stumbling, it wasn't right. So they pulled their sources together to have an MRI taken. Here she had a brain tumor that actually developed back when she did have health care insurance. She now has a debt over $250,000 that's going to follow around for the rest of her life.
Mm-hmm.
And each year, my daughter and all of Ann's friends get together, and they've reduced that to about half. But that's not fair. I mean, it just isn't fair that someone could be on the verge of bankruptcy. And if people who have health care think, well, that could never happen to them, let me just tell you, we are all one pink slip away of losing our health care. And, you know, it's one thing to sacrifice as an adult, but how many of us would want to see our children not have the kind of health care that's needed?
It's not a commodity.
It's not.
Like a yacht or a boat that some people will want and some people will never use or want in their whole life. It's something that threatens all of us, that we're going to, each one, 100% of us is going to potentially have some need
for
health care.
And here's the hypocrisy on the health care debate. Let's say, for sake of argument, this was truly going to be a capital market-driven system. Well, just like we go out and buy a car, we can shop around and look at Toyotas, Buicks, Chryslers, Chevys, you know, Hyundai, pick and choose and design. We know what the costs are. We even know what the maintenance is going to be. They don't do that in healthcare. If they truly are going to be market-driven, then post your prices. Post your infection rates. Post your infant mortality rate. Post your successful rates on how often do you have to come back and recorrect the surgery, so I can pick and choose which hospital that I want to go to. We don't do that. So on the one hand, let the free marketplace do, but oh no, we don't want to reveal the facts or our prices. And I find that incredibly insulting, because you don't need a PhD, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to realize that someone's pulling the wool over your eyes.
Our guest today on All About Living, Nino Amato, President and Executive Director of the Coalition of Wisconsin Aging Groups. And as you can see, he's on top of some pretty controversial issues, and we'll continue the conversation with Nino after these messages from our sponsors. You're listening to All About Living here on Madison 1670 WTDY. The program is also available on carolcobyradio.com, or tune in anytime to WTDY.com when you're out of the listening area, and you will have available to you all of the programs that are on live at that time. So we'll be right back with Nino. Welcome back to the program, and this segment is brought to you by Home Health United. You got a friend right here online at homehealthunited.org. Our guest today on the program, Nino Amato, President and Executive Director of the Coalition of Wisconsin Aging Groups. And we're across the board here on issues important to seniors, actually seniors and all generations, not only in Wisconsin, but across the nation. But right now, you are interested and you focus and you advocate for the people of Wisconsin.
Sure.
And one of the big things that the changes that has come about since the Walker administration got into power is the voter ID. And how does the voter ID legislation particularly affect seniors? And what is your message to them to make sure that they get their ID and that they get to the polls and they do vote?
This is really an intergenerational issue. And let me just share some facts with people. There's 1.2 million elderly and people with disabilities in this state out of a population of 5.5 million. The voter ID, most people support a voter ID. And people are concerned about the integrity of our voting place. And early on in my career, I was very concerned about whether or not there was voter fraud. What was very interesting in between 2002 and 2007, the U.S. Justice Department took 300 million votes and did an asset test on potential fraud. And when they were doing this, I was thinking, wow, it'd be interesting to see what they come up with. They came up with 83 fraudulent votes out of 300 million. There was people screaming in Wisconsin, massive voter fraud. You can count the number of voting fraud on two hands in the state of Wisconsin. And one fellow had voted twice, and he was retired. He lived in Florida for 6 months of the year, didn't think he was going to be back, voted several months ahead of time, came back for a family emergency, realized he voted, and he turned himself in. There was another big hoop to do in Chicago, where this was a national group that was demanding that there was massive voter fraud, and they said so-and-so from the cemetery voted and see who's here. So the reporter went over to the person's house, and here the guy was cutting his grass saying, you're supposed to be dead. And his response was, well, if this is heaven, I hate to see what hell's like. Okay? So fear tactics, massive voter fraud. There isn't massive voter fraud. But for the sake of argument, let's have IDs. Now, if you want IDs, then we have the technology that when you walk into the polls, you should be able to get an ID then and sign a statement. But this administration is saying that if you don't have a driver's license, you have to get now a voter ID, which means that someone who no longer drives like my mother has to find her way to the DMV. Now, it's easy in Madison. It's probably easy in Milwaukee and other metropolitan areas. But sure, in the rural areas, it's very, very difficult.
The offices aren't even open every day.
Correct.
And I've heard some real horror stories from northern Wisconsin.
Sure. And the governor tried to propose this during his budget repair bill without putting a budget allocation for the cost of voter ID, which is a poll tax. This is what the segregationists did in the South. Okay, and they use poll tax to prevent people from doing it. And at one time in this country, you had to be a property owner to basically be able to vote. So we made this incredible transition in this country. So what the governor now has passed a bill that if you don't have a voter ID and you go to vote, so in my case, my mother, she showed up after voting year after year after year, she would have to cast a provision ballot and then only have, I believe, 36 hours to go to a DMV to have her picture taken to come back. Now, that's obstructionism.
Mm-hmm.
And my concern is this is going to impact people with disabilities. It's going to impact seniors. It's going to discriminate against students. And it's, quite frankly, anti-patriotic and anti-American.
I thought we were supposed to make it easy for people to vote.
Yes. But this all gets down to politics. And I hate to say it, this is one of those hardball political games being played. The reason why some extremists on the Republican side want to have difficulty for people to vote is because two-thirds of the record number of votes cast for the first time in the 2008 elections. In the history of this country, there was more people who voted first time in 2008 than any other period in time, even during World War II. And only a third, less than a third, went Republicans and two-thirds went Democrats. Now, this begins to stink of partisanism. And it even begins to stink more of partisanism when they start closing DMV offices in heavily Democratic areas, but increased DMV offices in heavily Republican areas. Or an internal memo shows up that instructs the DMV employees, who are paid by the taxpayers, to tell people, you don't have to pay for this. And if they give you a check, take it. Now, something is seriously wrong. And I think that we're working with other organizations to call upon the U.S. Attorney General to intervene, not to turn over the voter ID law, but to modify the voter ID law that would allow people to get a ID at the polling place. Plain and simple. But to force people under the current structure and time frame. And then we just learned a month ago that instead of hiring a Wisconsin firm to do the voter IDs, they hired a California firm. The question is, how long is it going to take back? What's the time period to get your ID? So the whole thing is convoluted in what appears to be a crammed down power play to create Wisconsin a one-party system.
I have seen examples that have been sent to me of people who have been in, who've gone to a DMV office and the lines have been huge. And they bring all this identification with them, but they're missing one little thing. The list of the things that they need to prove their identification to get a voter ID card is monumental. And they get turned away and you have to come back. And maybe the office, and this one office is only open on a Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have to come back a week later and they've taken a bus or gotten somebody to drive them because it's not even in the community that they live in. And there are numerous examples of this, and it's just an unwieldy list of what has to be shown.
And here you have, too, is I can't recall off the top of my head the two counties where their county courthouse had burned down. There's no records of certificates for those people. What are you going to do then? And we're not talking about the hospital certificate with our cute little feet on it, okay? That doesn't qualify you for a voter ID. You need the actual certificate.
Mm-hmm.
And what's really bizarre, in a country like Australia, I think there's 20 million people. They have mandatory voting. You get penalized on your tax form if you don't show up and vote. So they're encouraging people to vote.
Mm-hmm.
Here's this country who's done more for democracy and become a model. We're now discouraging voters from voting by putting up roadblocks. And in many ways, what's being proposed is kind of a backdoor poll tax. Because when you look at the elderly voters, people with disabilities, people who are the working poor, and students, what are they afraid of?
Well, I get concerned when I hear statements like yesterday on the national news. Reince Priebus was interviewed. He's now the head of the Republican National Committee and came out of Wisconsin. And they were talking about voter ID and this idea that it's kind of like a poll tax, and it's regressive as far as getting people to the polls. And he used Wisconsin as an example that, well, we moved ahead and got voter ID and voter identification requirement for voting because Wisconsin was riddled with voter fraud. He used the word riddled, and I know that that is not
Absolutely. True
because I've looked at the League of Women Voters numbers, and there's no, I mean, it's less than 10.
It's absolutely.
And it's usually a confusion.
It's fraudulent. It is scare tactics. Wisconsin has, and let me say this, many people who might be listening might recall that when I was young and foolish and out of graduate school, I ran for mayor. I beat the incumbent in the primary, lost in general, which I contend is the best thing that happened to me. We thought there was massive voter fraud because there was over 20,000 absentee ballots cast. We went through every single ballot. We didn't find one voter fraud mm-hmm. in the city of Madison. What we should be concerned about is election fraud. When
yes.
somebody doesn't follow procedures and turns in ballots after the votes have been caught, like in Waukesha County, that should be an alarm for concern. When all of a sudden the numbers don't add up to the general numbers versus the specific numbers by ward, there should be concerns. That's where fraud's committed, is in elections. And you see that in third world countries. You even see that creeping into some other countries as well.
We need to stop for a break, and we're going to have just a couple minutes when we come back. But to learn about what you should do if you don't have a driver's license and you need a voter ID, can you go to the CWEG
Yes, we have information. Website. You can call our main number, which is 221-0606, and we have information. Also, the League of Women Voters have a great deal of information on what needs to be done. We're actually doing a two-prong initiative. One is educate people so that they get the voter IDs, and we'll be working with people into the next election. And second of all, we do want to challenge this with the U.S. Attorney General to intervene, to either modify the law so that it's easier to get voter IDs, or say the law is unconstitutional.
And we'll have these numbers and the websites that Nino mentioned on carolcobyradio.com. So if you want to look those up, they'll be available to you there. You're listening to All About Living here on Madison 1670 WTDY. Our guest is Nino Amato from the Coalition of Wisconsin Aging Groups, and we'll be back with our final minutes with Nino after these messages. And this final segment of our program is brought to you by Turville Bay MRI and Radiation Oncology Center in Madison, where expertise with compassion is powerful medicine. Nino Amato is here. He is the president and executive director of the Coalition of Wisconsin Aging Groups. And you have a long list of issues and problems, resources that you are working on to better serve and advocate for Wisconsin's seniors and their families. And just to do kind of an overview, we've talked about senior care, we've talked about the Affordable Care Act, voter ID, the Alzheimer's issues, and whether Alzheimer's and dementia gets put into the mental illness category or is treated as a disease as it is. And what is on the top of your list? What are your priorities, and how can CWEG help our listeners?
Well, in a very generic sense, and I'm going to appeal to the baby boomers out there, I think many of us back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s thought that we made all the right changes to help society as a whole, and then something went astray, you know, in the 90s, and then this last decade. And many of us, I think, felt that we could retire and do all the volunteer work and never have to reengage in politics. Guess what? The world has changed in the last 10 years. We have to reengage. Had people not reengaged, from baby boomers to their children to their grandchildren, to help our seniors on senior care and get Republicans and Democrats working together, that would have been a tragedy for 92,000 people. People do have to reengage. And without that, we're going to be in trouble. And as much as we've earned our credits to sit back and relax, we owe it to our children to continue being politically engaged.
Thank you, Nino Amato, Coalition Wisconsin Aging Groups, carolcobyradio.com. We'll have the contact information and this program available to you there. Thank you for listening to All About Living.